This is a recording of the Eric Dumont teleconference with National Environmental Trust on December 11th, 2007 at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions with instructions given at that time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Eric Dumont. Sir, please begin.
Thanks. Hi, and thank you all for joining. I'd like to welcome everyone to the call. My name is Eric Dumont, and I'm Virginia Representative for National Environmental Trust. National Environmental Trust is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization established in 1994 to inform citizens about environmental problems and how they affect our health and quality of life. I'm joined on the phone today by Joe Bouchard, recently elected delegate from Norfolk and former commander of the Norfolk Naval Station, Nathan Lott, executive director of the Virginia Conservation Network, Carl Bren, founder and director of Green Visions Consulting, and Councilman Dave Norris of the Charlottesville City Council. So as you heard, the way this works is we're going to present first and then we'll go to questions and answer after that. Today, National Environmental Trust is releasing a report called Taking Responsibility, Why the U.S. Must Lead the World in Reducing Global Warming Pollution. This report looks at why it is imperative that the U.S. get off the sidelines and join the efforts to stem greenhouse gas emissions. Specifically, takes on the charge that the U.S. cannot take action on global warming until or unless the developing nations of the world also take action. While we strongly believe that it is every nation's responsibility, we also believe that the U.S. is the leader of the free world, has a special responsibility to also be the leader of the green world. We can't sit and wait for the rest of the world to act. We need to act now and lead by our own example. Since 1992 and the Rio Accords, the world has more or less agreed on what is called differentiated responsibility. That is that different nations, industrialized nations especially, have different levels of responsibility to address greenhouse gas reductions. But the U.S. government doesn't agree with this principle. President Bush said in September of this year, quote, "Together, our nations will pave the way for a new international approach on greenhouse gas emissions. This new approach must involve all the world's largest producers of greenhouse gas emissions, including developed and developing nations." Just yesterday, actually, in Bali, where the governments of the world are meeting to produce an international framework to address greenhouse gas reductions, the Bush administration rejected any talk of actually setting specific goals. And, quote, "I don't think it's prudent to start out with a set of numbers. We're here to talk about the differences and try to resolve them." And that was from the administration's chief climate negotiator, Harlan Watson, as reported in the Washington Post. As it happens, we are the largest producer of greenhouse gas emissions. Our politicians can no longer use developing countries' emissions as an excuse not for us to act on climate change. The U.S. is over 27% of the cumulative global warming pollution, while all developing nations' emissions put together is just 23%. Fairness alone dictates that the U.S. must take the global lead in reducing that pollution. Our report has provided some perspective on the President's claim that the U.S. can wait until developing nations, especially China and India, make their own move to address emission reductions before we act. Despite the fact that China will soon overtake the U.S. in annual carbon dioxide emissions, it will be mid-century before they overtake the U.S. in total historical carbon dioxide emissions. And China is taking or has taken steps that the U.S. has not. For instance, China has fuel efficiency standards of over 35 miles per gallon by 2009 and has a renewable energy standard of 10% by 2010 and 20% by 2020. Assuming that the U.S. Senate and House agree this week, hopefully, to raise fuel efficiency standards to 35 miles per gallon by 2020, we'll at least be on par with China there, although we will still have no good prospects for a national renewable energy standard. Here in Virginia, which ranks 18th in big gas emissions, our emissions are equal to that of 83 developing nations combined, with a combined population of over 500 million people. For our part, Virginia is at least planning a plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So far, the federal government has taken no such steps. Our take-home message in the report is that we are responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than any other country, and we should be equally responsible for cutting more greenhouse gas emissions than any other country. Here to talk about some of the things that Virginia is currently doing and will hopefully do more of is Nathan Lott of the Virginia Conservation Network. Nathan?
Yes, Eric. Good afternoon. Thanks. Thanks to you, Eric, for having me on, and thanks to everyone who's on the call. As reporters for covering this important issue. just a little bit of background. Virginia Conservation Network is an umbrella organization, an association for conservation nonprofits and environmental nonprofits working all around the state of Virginia. And these groups are working with individuals at a very grassroots level, and they're working with policymakers and everyone in between. And I think that we've seen within the conservation world and the environmental community a tremendous willingness for individuals to take responsibility for their personal carbon footprint. And we've seen a lot of interest in changing light bulbs, changing purchasing habits, and really changing the way we eat, making lifestyle choices that will be more sustainable long term. People want to do that. They need information to do it. And in some cases, they need assistance both from the free market and from their communities. And I don't want to step on the toes of Carl and Dave, who are going to talk to them later, but I just want to acknowledge that we're hearing from businesses, and we're certainly hearing from communities like Charlottesville and Arlington and Fairfax and Williamsburg and many others that have made commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. So we know that individuals and communities and businesses in Virginia want to do the right thing, and they need help. They need help both from the state and from the federal level. At the state level, we're beginning to get the ball rolling. We certainly have a lot of work to do, but Governor Kane has made an executive order to lead by example within the state using increased energy efficiency and possibly some renewable energy purchasing for state agencies. We think that's a very positive step. It's the sort of thing that we hope will become standard policy for corporations and local governments, and have good reason to believe that that will be the case even after Governor Kane is out of office. Most notably, the state has released its first energy plan, a 10-year energy plan, something that CCN was very proactive in soliciting public input for. We were very engaged in turning folks out to have their say on the state's energy future, and we're appreciative that the administration and the Department of Mine, Minerals, and Energy took some of those comments into consideration in setting two sort of important targets within the plan. The first is for a reduction in CO2 and greenhouse gas emissions. And it's possibly not the most ambitious reduction that any state has on the books, but it's a significant step for Virginia. This time last year, we had no target whatsoever in terms of greenhouse gas reductions, and now we have one to turn the clock back and begin stepping down our greenhouse gas emissions from the state across all sectors, across the economy, transportation, building, industry, returning back to 2000 levels by 2025. I think that's imminently doable. I think we can actually do better than that, and I hope that we will. But we're not going to do it as a state acting alone. The other goal within that energy plan that, again, I think we may be able to do as a state, but certainly would be much more feasible with a national framework, is to increase efficiency. We have electricity. The plan calls for a 40% increase in efficiency that would actually lead to reversing a longstanding trend of energy use increase, turning that into a decrease in per capita energy demand. And that's exactly what Virginians want. That's exactly what Virginia needs in order to do its part and to take its responsibility. So, I think that's it in terms of background, and the takeaway that I really want to leave with you, and be happy to field questions later, is that Virginians, all the way from the man on the street up to the governor, are beginning to recognize the need for them to take responsibility, and have called on and made known that they want a partnership in that effort from the federal level. Governor Kane said it. All of the cities and counties that have signed on to the Mayor's Climate Change Protection or Climate Protection Agreement have included that in their statement. So I think there's a real consensus and a growing consensus in Virginia of the need for action at all levels. No more passing of the buck. And with that, I will turn it over to you, Eric.
Great. Thanks, Nathan. And again, folks who have questions, we'll take questions and answers at the end. And now I'd like to turn it over to Delegate-elect Joe Bouchard from Norfolk.
Thank you. First, as a point of correction, I'm actually in Virginia Beach, not Norfolk.
My mistake.
And my district is in the northwest corner of Virginia Beach, bounded on the north by Chesapeake Bay and on the east by the Lynn Haven River. Very low-lying, so of course I have a vested interest in climate change, and in particular the impact it will have on the rising sea level. But the main point I want to make, which is more important than the details I'll provide, is that the cost of inaction on global warming and climate change is far greater than the cost of taking decisive action. And I want to repeat that because it's important. The cost of inaction is far greater than the cost of taking decisive action. And the two points I'd like to address, first, as I alluded to concerning my district, is that global warming and the rise in sea level will have devastating impact on coastal Virginia, on the Chesapeake Bay, in the Tidewater region, the Eastern Shore. Just looking at my district, the projected 2-foot rise in the years ahead, which, depending on a number of variables, I acknowledge these things are hard to project, but the northern and eastern parts of my district would suffer very serious loss from a rise in sea level. The impact in several areas of Virginia Beach and Norfolk and Portsmouth would be very, very serious. It would have very negative consequences for the port of Hampton Roads. Several major terminals would be negatively impacted, and the cost of coping with the impact of climate change on these facilities that are critically important to Virginia's economy, such as the port, industrial areas located on the rivers and the harbor, and military bases, which I'll get to in a second, the cost of coping with the impact of sea level rise would be well into the billions of dollars, with no appreciable contribution to our economy, just preventing loss. That's not a wise investment of the taxpayers' dollars. Also, a few quick remarks on national security. I commend to everyone's attention a study done by the Center for Naval Analysis, hardly any kind of a liberal think tank. It's titled National Security and the Threat of Climate Change. It included the advice of 11 admirals and generals with a vast amount of experience in national security. So, once again, this is hardly a liberal group. They concluded that climate change is a serious threat to U.S. national security. They described it as a threat multiplier for instability in some of the most volatile regions of the world. Very sobering appraisal. They offered a set of 5 recommendations, 2 of which I want to mention real briefly. Their second recommendation was that the U.S. should commit to a stronger national and international role to help stabilize climate change at levels that will avoid significant disruption to global security and stability. Well, in essence, that's the conclusion of the Taking Responsibility report. And it's important for what I would call very conservative reasons, protecting our economy, protecting our national security. The last one, which is very personal to me, the last recommendation that was made in this study was that the Department of Defense should conduct an assessment of the impact on U.S. military installations worldwide of rising sea levels, extreme weather events, and other projected climate change impacts over the next 30 to 40 years. Those impacts would be severe. Here in the Hampton Roads area, Naval Station Norfolk, the world's largest naval base, with a $4.3 billion capital plant. That's the cost of the infrastructure. It's a very low-lying base. Parts of it are actually below sea level. The storm drains on the base had to have floodgates so that when we had an unusually high tide, we wouldn't flood. Significant parts of the base flooded in Hurricane Isabel, which was a relatively weak Category 1 hurricane. And a two-foot rise in sea level would make large portions of the base unusable, requiring hundreds of millions of dollars to restore that infrastructure. And several other bases, the Naval Amphibious Base at Little Creek, which is in my district, would be severely harmed. Langley Air Force Base up on the peninsula is on the water. It would suffer harm. And beyond the cost of to the military of protecting these bases, the rise in sea level impacts the surrounding community and transportation infrastructure and utilities that are critical to the bases. And that cost must also be factored in. Scores, maybe hundreds of other military bases worldwide would suffer, at least those on the coast would suffer similar impact. So we're talking probably about billions of dollars that would be required to cope with this. So from every perspective, there's a compelling case for action, in particular at the federal level. The United States needs to get on board, take leadership. The administration needs to stop whining about developing countries and take the leadership role that the United States should have and recognize that this is an opportunity for the United States. If we emphasize our strengths, our entrepreneurial spirit, our technical innovation, our technological innovation, decisive action on global warming is not a huge threat to the American economy, as has been warned. It's actually that decisive action is a huge opportunity. It just shifts the economic opportunity from what I would call the energy equivalent of Rust Belt industries to innovative sectors of the economy, where the United States is well poised to lead. And also at the state level, Governor Kaine in Virginia has taken first steps in the right direction. Those steps need to be pursued aggressively, as was recommended in the Virginia Energy Plan. It's time for Virginia to move on to a more aggressive climate action plan and to start implementing the measures that were proposed, that were called for in the governor's study. Mm-hmm. And again, this is not a threat to the economy of Virginia. This is an opportunity. And that those are the points I wanted to make. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Joe, for that sobering assessment. Now, to talk about some of those opportunities that might exist, we'll hear from Carl Brenn, the founder and director of Green Visions Consulting. Carl?
Thank you very much, Eric. Let me also tell you about a few of my other affiliations. I am the executive director of Earthcraft Virginia, which is a residential green builder program, which we have been for some time now implementing in the state. I'm also a member of the Governor's Energy Policy Advisory Council, which we're going to meet on the 19th of this month for the first time. And I hope, Joe, that we're going to get into the meat of how to implement that energy plan, because we must, and we must act aggressively. Let me talk a few minutes very briefly about the use of green building principles and practices and how that can have a major impact on reducing these greenhouse gases. As you can imagine, buildings have a huge impact on the environment. And, for example, they produce about 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions, 12% of the water use, 65% of water waste output, and almost 70% of our electricity consumption is used in the heating and cooling and operation of buildings. And so they may have a huge impact. The good news is this is, as Joe said, a huge opportunity for us in this state and this country. There was a report that just recently came out that was done. It was a year-long study done by the McKinsey Group, which most of you probably are familiar with, is one of the, I guess, premier consulting and management companies in the world. And this was from a story in the New York Times in which basically their conclusion was that the United States could shave as much as 20% of all the greenhouse gases simply by using current technology, primarily in making our buildings more efficient, and our buildings and our appliances. That is a huge, huge opportunity for us. I know in the work that I do, and I've been involved with green building for about 15 years, is that basically while we have great things are going on, and I want to compliment to Governor Kane and many other folks who are doing this around the state and the country, is that the opportunities, though, are still huge, and we're still only touching a very tiny percent of the buildings that are built either residential or commercial in this country. And so there's just a huge opportunity for us to make these buildings more energy efficient and so that we can reduce these greenhouse gases. The one thing that I think is so critical here is that, and I know that the energy plan in a number of places talks about the importance of increasing efficiency in so many ways. And if unless we increase the efficiency of our buildings and reduce the demand, what will occur, and in fact is occurring in Virginia and across the country, is that utilities and others are cranking up to produce more electricity through coal-burning power plants and nuclear and all the rest. And the good news is that we can actually meet the increasing demand for energy going forward with basically doing those things that really save us money and provide for a cleaner environment. One of the things in terms of doing green buildings, and of course I'm on another role that I play is I'm on the board of the James River Green Building Council, and we're involved with the promotion of green building in general, but also with the LEED system, which has had a huge impact on commercial buildings across the country and is now getting into a residential green building. But the savings that can be had by building a green building standards, typically the savings are at least 30% more efficient and going up to 50. And this is not that difficult to achieve, in addition to other savings of water and all the rest. One of the things, while we're talking briefly about water, water is also a huge energy consumer. The time you pump and filter and pump it to the house and clean the water and all the rest, a huge amount of energy is used in the provision of our water systems in this country. So there's really a great opportunity for us in the state and in the country in addressing these issues. One of the things that is often mentioned in regard to making this happen, however, you've got several difficulties. Is one, your utilities, we need to do something about the way in which they are compensated so that they make as much money in promoting conservation as they do in selling electricity. And that's one of the things that that I know has been studied and looked at, but until that happens, it's going to be very difficult for us to ask utilities not to actually sell electricity and produce it, and we need to do some things in order to change those incentives so that we're not encouraging more production through coal-burning power plants and other sources. I think that's mainly what I'd like to say right now. But again, I'm optimistic about what we can do because these are things. As opposed to what Joe was saying, in which we are basically taking so many actions just to stop damage. If we act now and move forward with taking these actions to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by doing those things that save us money on our energy bills, then why wouldn't we do that? So anyway, let me stop that right there and hand it off to the next person.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Carl. And our last speaker is Charlottesville City Councilman Dave Norris, who is going to actually tell us about some of the stuff that they've already been doing. If I'm not mistaken, some of those are even some of the things that you just talked about, Carl. But Dave, go ahead.
Thank you, Eric. I think what we're seeing is that with the lack of leadership on the federal level and to date on the state level, you're seeing a lot more cities and counties across the Commonwealth and across the country stepping into the breach and exercising some leadership on this issue. So while we're proud of what we've been able to do in Charlottesville, we're certainly not unique in trying to push the envelope. I did want to talk a little bit about some of the steps that we've taken in Charlottesville in the last couple of years particularly. And I think we're already seeing some pretty significant paybacks. But back in 2005, our city adopted a formal environmental management system, which really has resulted in significant energy savings and emissions reductions throughout our city operations. Things like started purchasing more hybrid vehicles for our city fleet, and we're now converting our entire fleet of city buses and school buses to biodiesel and city vehicles to compressed natural gas. One of the things that we've been really aggressive about is conducting energy audits on our municipal buildings and implementing some of those conservation measures and energy efficient retrofits that Carl was just mentioning, and already are realizing significant savings. Just from FY06 to FY07, we had a decrease in our city energy bills of $293,000 in 1 year alone. One of the more creative steps that we've taken, which I highly recommend to other localities, is last year we challenged our city schools to reduce their own energy use and to implement conservation measures in the city schools. And we created an incentive program where half of the savings that were realized through this effort were returned to the schools to use to buy supplies and equipment in their classrooms. The last year alone, the school system saved about $90,000 in energy costs, and half of those savings, about $45,000, went right back into the classrooms for supplies for teachers and equipment. And we created a little competition program where the schools sort of vied against each other to see who could save the most energy. Overall, last year, schools realized a 10% reduction in their use of electricity and a 30% reduction in natural gas. And as a result, last year, just in the school system alone, we had about 2.1 million pounds less of carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere through those efforts. Now, on top of some of the things that the city's been doing internally with our own operations in the school operations, last year our city council endorsed the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, which is something that many localities across the country have adopted, which is commits your locality, and not just within municipal operations, but the community as a whole, to reducing emissions, saving energy, and pursuing environmental sustainability in a variety of forms. And for Charlottesville, we didn't see that as just sort of an empty pledge. We actually are now aggressively working to implement this agreement. We've created a Citizens Committee on Environmental Sustainability, which includes a wide cross-section of our community, from business leaders to environmentalists to we have a builder, developer, we have neighborhood activists, all working together around four specific themes to develop proposals for really addressing this whole issue of climate change and energy and environmental sustainability. And the four themes are: one, green building; two is clean energy; three is materials management, recycling, reuse, reduction; and four is urban ecology. And in the wake of creating this committee, we also joined an international group called ICLEI, I-C-L-E-I, International Coalition of Local Environmental Initiatives. And joining this organization has given us access to some really cutting-edge software and technical support that's now allowing us to conduct a pretty holistic baseline inventory of carbon emissions and move toward development of a comprehensive climate action plan for our city. Some of the specific initiatives that we are now pursuing, in addition to some of the things I mentioned before, we are working, frankly, to revolutionize our public transportation system here in Charlottesville through a new regional transit authority that's going to take our city buses more places, more frequently, more reliably, with real-time information. And our hope is that through significantly expanding public transportation, we'll be able to move a lot more people out of their single-occupancy vehicles and onto transit system. We are shifting funds, local funds, out of road paving and investing more funds into bicycle and walking trails. We are actively working to increase our urban tree canopy. We've set a goal of, right now we have 32% canopy coverage in the city, and our goal is to get that up to 40% in fairly short order. We're looking at incentives for green building in Charlottesville. We are about to launch a major public outreach initiative regarding energy conservation, energy efficiency, and it's modeled after a program up in Arlington called Fresh Air, and it's been very successful up there. They actually distribute the compact fluorescent light bulbs. They help promote home energy audits. We're considering a program now that would actually assist some of our lower-income homeowners with making energy improvements. In addition, we have significantly expanded our recycling program locally, our curbside recycling program. Just within the last year, we're looking at really taking more waste products out of the waste stream. And then on a bigger picture level, is really aggressively trying to promote more of a smart growth strategy with regard to higher density urban infill, pedestrian, and transit-oriented development to reduce the reliance on single-occupancy vehicles and the increase of suburban sprawl and create a healthier community. Next Monday night at our council meeting on the 17th, in addition to everything I've just mentioned, we're going to be considering a clean energy policy, which would put the city on record as committing to purchase wind power when it becomes available through there's a new wind station coming online here in another year or two at Highland New Wind, looking at are there opportunities locally for generation of renewable energy, for instance, by leasing out city rooftops to third-party photovoltaic generators, redoubling our own commitment to conservation and efficiency both within city operations and among the public at large, and then calling upon the Commonwealth of Virginia and the General Assembly to implement a real renewable portfolio standard with mandated purchases of renewable energy by Dominion Power, and in addition, calling for a moratorium on any new coal or nuclear capacity until there are substantial investments by our utilities in renewable energy and conservation and efficiency measures. And I'll just wrap up by saying, you know, what we're doing here in Charlottesville and what we're hoping to do here in Charlottesville really is a drop in the bucket. What we need is aggressive federal leadership. What this report, I think, shows pretty clearly is that we are falling behind where we need to be as a nation. Frankly, we're falling behind where we need to be as a state. I'm very happy to see some of the things recently that come out of Governor Kane's office. But just one new coal-fired power plant, like the plant they're proposing down in Wise County, one new coal-fired power plant alone will undo virtually every measure I just mentioned in terms of what we're trying to do in the city of Charlottesville to reduce emissions and promote conservation and energy savings. So it really takes more of a big picture focus, and I commend the National Environmental Trust and the other partners on this call for helping to move this forward. So.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dave, and thanks, Nathan and Joe and Carl. So as you've all heard now, certainly from what Joe was saying about the impacts that we're likely to face, and you heard from Nathan about some of the, the fact, all those impacts that Joe was talking about are reasons why people are around the world and around our country are starting to step up and take responsibility, whether it's governments, as Nathan talked about, whether it's local governments, as Dave just talked about, or whether it's private businesses, as Carl talked about. And our whole take-home message is it's time for the federal government to step up and take their responsibility as well. And with that, we can go to questions.
Okay, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. And if at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, it's star 1 to ask a question, and we're currently holding for questions. Our first question comes from Patrick Lynch with the Daily Press.
Hi, everyone. This is Patrick Lynch. I'm with the Daily Press in Newport News. I had a question I guess I would first direct to Delegate-elect Bouchard. So you mentioned the threat to sort of local military bases. I was wondering, drawing on your past experience, has the naval station or any of the other local bases that you know of done any sort of study on the threat they face due to sea level rise, not only sea level rise, but, you know, sort of increases in inundations and storm surges and that sort of thing? Or does that, I guess, not exist at this point?
Yes, that's been studied by the Navy.
Okay.
And that was after my 3 years as the commanding officer of Naval Station Norfolk. For those of you who don't know, I spent 27 years in the Navy and was commanding officer of Naval Station Norfolk, so I do have a little bit of background in this.
Mm-hmm.
The work that the Navy has done to look at this, because it addresses military operations and the ability of these bases to carry out their mission, at least some of the work is classified.
Mm-hmm.
And the and I suspect that that's legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much that the information on the impact is classified, but the information on the capabilities and operations performed by the base.
Right.
Some of that information is classified, but the Navy is addressing this. I'm not aware of the details, but there is a follow-on effort that either the Joint Staff or DOD is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But let me say I'm not part of that.
Sure.
What I do know from my own experience with the impact of storms on these bases, it doesn't take very much of a rise in sea level to cause serious problems.
Mm-hmm.
Because keep in mind that the daily changing of the tides, a rise in sea level makes high tide more of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
A rise in sea level can make a nor'easter more of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
A strong nor'easter can have the same impact, the same tidal surge, the same impact on flooding as a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
So the rise in sea level itself, if you just look at a map, that may not look too bad, but when you take into account the impact that that has on tides and storms, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
This needs to be taken very seriously. And the Navy and DOD, they are looking at the impact on bases and the cost that it could have.
A quick follow-up to that. When you say need to be taken seriously, is that in the sense of the long-range action of what we sort of need to do as a state or as a country, or that in addition to what needs to be done with infrastructure at the individual bases to maybe mitigate some of this?
It would be much better for the American economy to invest in the innovative technology and the shift to the alternative energy sources that reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to keep our economy strong and to prevent the exacerbation of climate change and to try and minimize the rise in the sea level, than it would be to invest much larger sums in damage control, in shoring up threatened infrastructure both on the base and in the surrounding communities. That's particularly true, talking from my own experience, at Naval Station Norfolk. Keep in mind, all the utilities, the electricity, fresh water, the sewage system, all those services for the base are provided by the city or regional systems. All those systems are threatened by climate change. So the investment in damage control affects all the communities in Hampton Roads, well, throughout the Tidewater area, as well as the military bases. To me, it's clear that that investment in prevention will be much more cost-effective and make a much better contribution to the U.S. economy than investments in damage control.
And can you hear me? This is Nathan.
Yes.
Okay, well, I just want to echo what Joe is saying and pick up one point that I think that he touched on earlier when he was referencing the report that referred to global warming as a threat multiplier. Buttressing our bases and our infrastructure will have the effect of mitigating the effect of global warming on that infrastructure, but it won't do anything about the security implications, the instability implications of global warming that we see from droughts in the rest of the world or global migrations of people that the IPCC predicts will happen. And I think that that one of the real advantages to being proactive is that you mitigate some of the instability down the road in terms of international conflicts. And that obviously affects the many Virginians who serve in the armed services, whose families serve in the armed services. You know, we want global stability because, like it or not, we are often in the position to be at least part of a multinational policing force, if not taking unilateral actions to try and stabilize nations where we see unrest. So the security picture is well beyond our borders, and I think that understanding that is part of the reason that we see people like John Warner, Senator John Warner, being proactive on this, understanding the global picture.
I agree.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star 1. It doesn't look like we have any further questions at this time.
All right. Well, what I'll just say then to folks who are on the phone, first of all, thank you very much, Nathan, Joe, Carl, and Dave. And to the reporters who are on, if anyone has any other questions throughout the day, I have all of the speakers' contact info, and if you need to get a hold of any of them and don't already have it, feel free to call me, and I can put you in touch with them. And thank you all for joining us as well, then.
Yes, thank you very much, Eric.
Thanks, Eric. We enjoyed it very much. Good to connect with all you guys.
Yes, thank you, Eric.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye-bye.